Is my brain turning into soup? Why am I seeing aliens? Is it supposed to be like this? Why is it so hard to piss? Is that an interdimensional ball cube thing with too many angles on that ring thing? Did I just merge with my poodle? I wonder what we am. Maybe time is shaped just like a noodle. Maybe everything's a scam. One thing I know is I'm never coming down. I know that I'm never coming down. I haven't even peaked yet. Oh God, it's only been 30 minutes. 30 minutes, I wonder if 30 minutes could fit in the bed of a tiny squirrel truck. I'll never sleep again, I'll never sleep again. Who needs to sleep? I think I'll go see the TVs. Everyone's obsessed with death. I think I want to go to bed. Where are my Xanax? Maybe I'll just look at a picture of Ram Dass. Maybe I'll take Xanax and look at Ram Dass. Greetings, friends. It is I, D. Trussell, and this is the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. That song you just heard is called Never Coming Down. It's a classic Beach Boys original from their album Manta Ray Surf the Tube Rainbow of Light. The guy seems cool. Let's go to the beach. And you can find that on Amazon.com. Holy shit. This episode that you are about to listen to is real good. When you've done as many podcasts as I have, it's hard to say, well, this is my favorite DTFH. And I don't think I'll ever say that because I love all of my children in different ways. But this one is the kind of podcast that makes me happy for weeks after recording it. If you've ever wondered, what the fuck is happening in my brain right now? When you've been enjoying a psychedelic, then Andrew Gallimore has the answer for you. Andrew is a neurobiologist, chemist, pharmacologist, and an author. He's written some incredible books. He has my favorite feed on Twitter. It's incredible. If you're wondering what the neurological explanation for the K-hole is, it's there. You can also find that on his Substack or by going to his website, buildingalienworlds.com. We are going to dive into this incredible conversation that covers all of my favorite topics, the singularity, DMT, DMT elves, entities, time travel, and Terrence McKenna. Folks, I got lots of dates coming up, but the closest one is February 2nd. I'm going to be back at Zany's in Nashville. You can get tickets by going to their website, which you'll find at DuncanTrussell.com. Also, won't you subscribe to my Patreon? It's patreon.com/DTFH. It's an incredible, thriving, beautiful community of high-powered, erotic intellectuals. They want to meet you. I want to meet you. Come hang out with us twice a week. It's patreon.com/DTFH. All right, friends, I am so happy to introduce to you the author of many great books, most recently, Reality Switch Technologies. Again, you can find that by going to alieninsect.net. Everybody, welcome to the DTFH, Andrew Gallimore. Andrew, welcome to the DTFH. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I have been looking forward to this for days, man. How are you doing out there in Japan?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for having me on. It's a bright and cold morning here in Tokyo. Oh wow!
But nice to talk to you for the first time. I think this is the first time we've spoken.
This is the first time we've spoken, except some DMs through Twitter. I don't remember how I found your Twitter. I feel so lucky that I did. Like, you have got the best Twitter on earth for anyone who enjoys psychedelics. And obviously there's a lot of psychedelic Twitters out there and avenues out there, but you really thread the needle for me between mysticism and chemistry and answer so many questions that I have personally had when I have experienced DMT, ketamine. The thing you wrote about the what's happening when you go into a K-hole, oh my God, that is so edifying for someone who enjoys the K-hole. Like, oh fuck, that's what's happening? The synaptic clefts, glutamate? I suspected it was glutamate.
Yeah.
How'd you get into this? How did you get into the world of the chemistry of psychedelics? What brought you into this?
Well, I was just like every kind of slightly unusual teenager who was interested in drugs. I mean, all teenagers are interested in drugs. Well, not
absolutely.
All of them. All the cool ones. We shouldn't say that,
right.
But we shouldn't say that. But
not anymore. It was the old days, kids.
Yeah, I was. I was interested in drugs. I got really interested in, but I was also quite of a, weirdly, when I was really young, I was kind of a bookish kid, right? I was interested in, I used to read a lot about science. And then when I became a teenager, those things kind of clashed beautifully.
Right. Yeah.
And I found myself needing to learn about these molecules. And, I thought, I need to study chemistry. I need to study pharmacology and neuroscience and all those things, because I really want to understand. I used to leaf through books about psychedelic. Well, not about psychedelic. They didn't really have them in those days. I could find. You had to send off to Loom Panics Company in California or something.
Right.
And order them by mail order. And I was too young to be doing that. Didn't have the money. But anyway, I would. I used to go on the early internet when I had to go to school and ask for the password from the IT technician for the internet, because there's only one internet in the school at that time, and search for everything I could. I spent hours and hours, like missed my lessons in chemistry and stuff, because I was alta vistering all about DMT and Terence McKenna, and it was just a whole world that I didn't have a clue existed. And I suddenly realized, oh my God, there's this whole thing been waiting for me all, my entire 16 years of my life.
What you're describing is it's an experience that I'm happy is gone, which is that having to do this kind of like underground research to connect with any of the data. I'm glad it's gone. But I think what kids or anyone who's interested in psychedelics and newly interested in psychedelics, what they're going to miss out on is the delight find out that some of your intuition regarding these things, that they aren't driving you insane, that in fact they seem to be illuminating your life in a beautiful way, that they're even maybe helping your focus or having some kind of cognitive benefit. But all the propaganda in those days was, this shit is going to drive you nuts. You're going to end up trying to flip a cop car. Your brain is being fried. You're going insane. You'll become schizophrenic. And so that moment you stumble upon Terence McKenna.
Yes.
And suddenly, not only is there a person saying, actually, these things have been sacraments for maybe all of human history, but then also in that flowery language, perfectly articulating the experiences you've been having, to the point where I remember my first reading him for the first time, I felt like I was tripping. Just that ability to bring that world into this world, it was thrilling and Something about it felt so edgy. That's kind of gone now, right? That's sort of...
Yeah, I think so. I think when I first discovered Terence McKenna, he's been a constant influence throughout my life. You know, he's a constant source of ideas. You know, you listen to a Terence McKenna lecture and little ideas spark off him. Right. It's like a piece of flint rolling down a mountain. And you think, oh, I'd never thought of that before. And then I find myself doing a little bit of research. And often, you know, some of the articles and things and ideas that have found their way into my writing and my books were kind of engendered by just a little something that Terence McKenna said without thinking, and then never really followed it up. You know, not like his main thesis, but just little things, little sparks that get your attention and make you think. And you think, oh, I need to study that. And then something comes out of it. So he's incredibly important. He's not always right about everything. You know, his science isn't always on the nail. And I know Dennis likes to point out when he gets the science wrong, his brother, Dennis McKenna. But, you know, there was nobody else like him, I think. Someone who was so widely read across so many different subjects in philosophy and science and fucking alchemy and you name it. He was able to kind of bring all of these disparate, quite strange, you know, on their own, quite strange fields, unusual fields like Jungian psychology and stuff and ufology, and bring them all together. And then in this beautiful melting pot of his mind, and what came out were these incredibly novel ideas. And it's such fertile ground for people like myself who are interested in new ideas about psychedelics. I'm not interested so much in the obvious things or just reading the paper, you know, the academic literature and kind of saying, this is what it says. I'm more interested in absorbing all of these ideas and trying to think beyond that, because I think DMT demands that. We're not in the position as orthodox kind of scientists, we're not in a position to say this is what's happening with DMT. We're still so much for us to know, so much for us to learn, so much we really don't understand. And it requires you, I think, to push out, push beyond the boundaries and think of new ideas and new ways of looking at what's going on. And Terence McKenna is very important, though.
Are you familiar with the term swamp gassing? You ever heard this in UFO talk? It's
no.
it's like the UFO word for gaslighting, swamp gassing, which is that almost immediately, anyone who reports an encounter with a UFO is negated by mainstream culture. And so this is called swamp gassing. You saw swamp gas, you saw a satellite, so it's called swamp
gas. Yeah,
weather balloons. That's right. Like the most mundane explanation, and generally an explanation that completely flies in the face of the report that this person is given. And this is happening in the military for a long time. That is beginning to change now because for a lot of different reasons. But with DMT, a form of swamp gassing happens, which is, of course you're seeing shit like that. You're high. What, you're going to believe that shit's real? You think there's really you really saw an elf? You're fucking frying your brain, man. So, you know, it's swamp gassing. You're discredited. Right. And you know, I'm sure you hear this a lot because you do lectures and you're around psychonauts a lot. And I think it's a very sad thing when somebody has to preface whatever insight they had with, but you know, I was really high. I was high, you know, I was as though the experience itself completely negates the data that was received within that zone. So this is something I'm very excited about that you are doing. I love the article you wrote on Graham Hancock's website regarding the DMT entities. And I just wonder if we could just talk a little bit about your theories regarding these, whatever you want to call them. Terence McKenna famously called them self-transforming machine elves. Mm-hmm. I never saw those things, or what did he call them? Not toddlers. He had a name. Like, he called
them
tights. Yes, yes, yes. But I would love to hear your theories on what these things are.
Yeah, so the self-transforming machine elves, it's interesting, right? Because everyone associates the machine elves with Terence McKenna. That's the number one thing. When you think of Terence McKenna, you think of self-transforming machine elves dribbling basketballs, right?
Yeah.
And what's interesting about machine elves, well, not machine elves specifically, right? But we're talking about, it's, to put it in scientific parlance, we're talking about a type of Lilliputian hallucination. Where hallucinations of little people is how it would be described in the literature.
Right.
So Terence McKenna, of course, made them famous. He made them really famous. And when other people started seeing machine elves and started reporting them, this was Terence McKenna appeared kind of in the 80s, really. I mean, he really burst onto the circuit, whatever that psychedelic circuit looked like. I was too young. But once he started writing about it and it started getting onto the internet, it became very well known, these machine elves. And then other people started saying, oh, I saw the same thing. I also saw these little, and they take various forms. So machine elves is perhaps not the best term for them. They always take the form of very small, lively, mischievous, trickstery, jovial, happy-go-lucky, this kind of thing. They move very, very quickly. They dance around. They jump in and out of your body. They often display these objects, often described, Terence McKenna described them as like these hyperdimensional Fabergé egg or something.
Yes.
These incredibly beautiful hyperdimensional objects. They would show you and say, look at this. They like to put on a display. That's kind of their overall character, if you like. But their form, the way that they appear, you know, whether they look like typical Irish leprechauns sometimes, or sometimes they look like little balls of stuff that is self-transforming, constantly forming themselves out of the material of the space. So they're unified by their character, but they often have different visual form. Now, what people started saying is that, well, you all listen to Terence McKenna. That's why you're seeing machine elves, because Terence McKenna told you we're going to see machine elves. And that's a difficult one to argue against at face value, because you say, well, a lot of people did. But then a lot of people didn't. And actually, we can go before McKenna. We can go back to... Well, let's go right back to the beginning. How far can we go back? We can go back to 1956, which is when Stephen Zara, the Hungarian physician who self-administered DMT for the first time, he synthesized it, he injected it intramuscularly, and he had the world's first pure DMT trip sometime in 1956. I think it was in April. Anyway... he started injecting it. In those days, it was pretty simple to do a study. He just kind of got volunteers from the hospital, his colleagues, I think, some patients, that kind of thing. Come on, gather around. And he injected them all with DMT. And there's a very interesting report in that very first study of a woman, I think it was, who describes these small beings. She said dwarf-like beings that move around very quickly. That's all we got in terms of the trip report. She wasn't asked to expand upon it. But there, straight there, from this very first study, you're starting to see something that sounds suspiciously like an elf, right? Yeah. It's a small being that's lively, that's moving very, very quickly.
Right.
Then as we go through some of the more popular DMT users, let's take Owsley, who created, I think it was Orange Sunshine, right?
Right.
Owsley. He did an interview where he was talking about DMT, and he mentioned he saw what he described as the Tinker Toy Men. Again, with these little lively beings that you saw. Yes. Timothy Leary as well would talk about these small, mischievous little creatures dancing around in the DMT trip. So it's not, we can't put it all down to a McKenna effect. It seems to be an intrinsic part of the DMT state. It's one of the characters that, whether you've listened to Terence McKenna or not, one of the characters that you are likely to come across, one of the entity types you are likely to encounter in the DMT space is going to be these very small, lively, giggling, mischievous little beings that Terence McKenna called machine elves.
Right.
Now, what are they? That's a different question. Why do you see them? That's a different question. I think quite difficult to answer. Mm. We have some clues. We can look at archetypal structures. So the archetype of the trickster, the archetype of the clown, these kind of universal experiences that go back to, you know, long before 1956. We're talking thousands and thousands of years.
Yes.
Elves, obviously, leprechauns, small dwarf-like beings feature in the mythology, not just in Irish mythology. Everyone's, of course, familiar with Gaelic, the kind of Irish folklore of the leprechaun and the elves and things.
Yeah.
But actually, you can go back much further than that, and you find, you know, in Mexico, in other parts of South America, in Africa, you find these myths about these little mischievous beings that play tricks on people or lie to people throughout mythology. So it's like you're tapping into something there. The mechanism is not so easy to explain.
Right.
DMT seems to allow you to tap into that thread, if you like, that's been running for thousands of years. And, you know, the elves, they come out of the pages of folklore, apparently, you know, but they're kind of brought back to life when you smoke DMT. You're actually able to confront and meet these things that most people would only ever hear stories about.
I want to thank BetterHelp for supporting this episode of the DTFH. Let's face it, shambling around in a big pile of sentient meat, living on a planet with a civilization that seems like it's either on the brink of transforming in some kind of technological utopia or being eradicated in blasts of nuclear light, solar flares, or any of the other many threats that we all know about because they get blasted into our brains 24/7 by the internet isn't exactly the easiest thing, which is why sometimes you need a therapist. Therapists are trained to help you figure out the cause of challenging emotions, learn productive coping skills, and they are the best listeners on earth. Sometimes that's all you need. BetterHelp has connected over 3 million people with licensed therapists. It's convenient, accessible anywhere, and 100% online. As the world's largest therapy service, BetterHelp has matched 3 million people with professionally licensed and vetted therapists available 100% online, plus it's affordable. You just fill out a brief questionnaire to match with a therapist. If things aren't clicking, you can easily switch to a new therapist anytime. It couldn't be simpler. No waiting rooms, no traffic, no endless searching for the right therapist. Learn more and save 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/Duncan. That's BetterHelp.com/Duncan. Thank you, BetterHelp, for supporting this episode of the DTFH.
When you smoke DMT, you're actually able to confront and meet these things that most people would only ever hear stories about.
Right. Yes. Mm. And there is a something to me that there's a difference in this experience compared to other psychedelics. You know, LSD has always seemed like a way to kind of see your own projections in the world. You can sort of watch the way your mood states will shift whatever you might be seeing on the walls. Maybe you're seeing, I don't know if you've seen it. I do think it's somewhat common. The skull thing, or you're looking at your ceiling. Why the fuck did we take this? The ceiling is now skulls or yawning, gaping mouths or disintegration, death, the classic death.
But your
mood shifts, and it seems like that tapestry begins to change or reflect the shifting of your mood. I've always thought we're probably just seeing what we're always projecting into the world via some, I don't know what, that's maybe you understand that, but with DMT, commonality in spaces visited and in whatever these beings are, to me, this is where it gets really interesting. Surely, and I think I was, you tweeted Strassman, they're doing a new study trying to use some form of anesthesiology mixed in with DMT to create a more stable DMT trip. So that we can maybe spend a little more time in there recording the geography and the biology of this place. This is the difference, right? Like, what are some other psychedelics that create shared experiences for people that you can think of?
Well, DMT is certainly, that's the number one. I mean, what's beautiful about DMT, as you say, is that it has a number of pharmacological peculiarities that make it really interesting, in that it takes you so deep, so fast, but then pulls you out again just as quickly a few minutes later.
Right.
It has this, it's not like with, if you wanted to get, you can, people do say, if you take very high doses of mushrooms, for example, you can approach these DMT. It starts to become DMT-esque at very high doses, and you can start to approach the DMT space. But, you know, you have to take high doses. You have to deal with that for hours and hours and hours on end.
Yeah.
You know, once you're in, and it will come in waves, and it's very difficult to manage for most people. But with DMT, it's like a bungee jump. One of those bungee jumps that drops you into the water, you know, like, you're in there, for a few minutes, and then you're dragged out again. Like, how the fuck was that? You know, that's kind of the DMT. That's what's amazing about DMT, is it's unique in that it can, well, apart from maybe salvinorin, which is a different beast altogether, but but DMT is not, DMT seems to, for most people, when they take DMT, it has this comical, it's astonishing, it's shocking, it's horrifying in many ways, but that's just your kind of emotional response to it, I think, because it is so fucking strange, you know, bizarre, right? As Terence McKenna used to always say, these are bizarre dimensions, you know, and they really are. Yeah. Nothing can prepare you for that. But generally, and you can look at the studies that have looked at the types of entities that you meet there, because it's who you meet that's really interesting, not so much where you go. Although that itself is a level 10 on the intensity scale.
Yes.
But who you meet is really what makes the trip. And studies have shown generally that about 95%, more than 90% of the time, you're going to meet somebody or meet entities that are nice, right? They're going to be friendly. They're going to be welcoming. They're going to have a great party when they see you burst through the veil into their domain. Or they're going to guide you around, help you, you know, all these kind of things, teach you. So that's kind of nice about DMT. It is shocking. It is horrifying. It is terrifying, like a roller coaster when you first burst into the space. But once you're in there, generally the entities... display some kind of beneficence. They, it looks like they're very smart and they're very wise and they don't want to harm you for the most part.
Right.
With Salvia, it's a different beast. That, you know,
yeah, totally.
But then it's like mainly 90% of the time, it's kind of flipped. 90% of the time, it's just a horrible experience for most people. But DMT isn't like that. So DMT, I think, is the perfect molecule for studying the commonalities between, you know, going back to commonalities. I think DMT is the perfect molecule for doing that, because you can put people in very deeply. And as you were talking about this extended state, so this is something that I and myself and Rick developed this idea, this technology, if you like.
My apologies. I did not know you were involved in it with Strassman.
It was my idea.
I noticed you mildly wince, and I want to deeply apologize.
I'm not joking.
What did I say? Okay. Yeah, I love it. Okay, got it. Got it.
Yeah. So that idea came to me. I was looking at reading about and write, or maybe I was writing an article, and the different pharmacological features of DMT, it's very short acting. It doesn't have subjective tolerance. So you can inject someone with DMT 15 minutes later, inject them again, and they'll have exactly the same intensity of experience.
Right.
Rick Strassman showed this in his study in the 90s. It doesn't have any toxicity. It's rapidly metabolized and cleared from the body. So it struck me that these are exactly the pharmacological requisite properties of drugs used in anesthesiology to put people into an anesthetized state. You inject them with a controlled infusion to maintain a stable brain drug concentration throughout the surgery. And there's a whole science that's developed, a whole technology that's developed over the last few decades about how do you control the infusion rate into the bloodstream such that the individual's brain kind of maintains the desired level of drug, and you can kind of control it. You can push them deeper. You can bring them into a more shallow state by reducing the infusion rate, all this kind of stuff. And it occurred to me, you know, we can use this exact same technology with DMT. Why not? So then I contacted Rick and said, I need your blood data, because he had the blood data. He injected people in the 90s with DMT and then measured their blood DMT concentration over time. So that was the data I needed. And from that, I built this, what's called a pharmacokinetic model. So it's a model of how DMT is distributed and metabolized by the body and ultimately in the brain, and use that to basically build a kind of proof of principle model that would show, yes, this is possible with DMT, it can be done. So we published this paper with Rick Strassman. And now, you know, after the paper was published, it got quite a bit of attention for kind of obvious reasons.
Sure.
People were saying, oh, it's like, you know, the Matrix machine, and scientists are using this machine to communicate with aliens. And of course, that was all a little bit jumping the gun, so to speak. But Imperial College London, one of the foremost psychedelic research groups in the world, have just completed a trial in humans using this DMTX infusion technology. So they will be publishing that, I think, sometime in the new year.
Holy shit.
So you can actually bring someone into the DMT state, hold them there, and quite stable as well. So they're not, it's not like with an injection where they're kind of fired in and then they kind of trail out again or pulled out. You can actually hold them at quite a stable level in the study. I think they just did 30 minutes, but there's no reason why that can't be extended.
30 minutes?
Yeah.
30 minutes in there.
Yeah.
Think of that. And so do you know, like, what are the trip reports from this? Can you talk about it yet? Like what was the experience like?
Well, yeah, I can't say too much because I don't know that much. I think they're fairly tight-lipped about it. I mean, they've spoken at a couple of conferences. I was at a conference in in Yorkshire in the UK a couple of months ago, and they were all on the stage. So I gave my talk, and I was about DMT and stuff, and then they were on the same day on the same stage, kind of there's like four or five of them all talking about the very first people to undergo this extended state. So it's kind of really exciting because I'd actually spoken, I presented the idea 7 years previously at the same symposium, saying that this would be possible. And then 7 years later, they were the first subjects to have undergone this. So were kind of on the stage talking about their experiences. And wow. Yeah, it was really nice to see these, you know, little ideas that come to fruition. And so it's kind of really exciting for me to see these kind of things actually start to be realized and people starting to take DMT seriously as a molecule worthy of, or the DMT state as something worthy of spending some research dollars on. And but in terms of the actual experience, what they was able to establish is that you can, as I predicted, I mean, what I predicted would happen is, so it's a little bit technical, but when DMT enters your brain, what's happening is your brain world model, your brain's reality model is being switched. So your brain is constructing all the time, whenever you are conscious, or even when you're unconscious, if you're dreaming, for example, your brain is constructing its model of reality, its world model, using neural information. And when you enter the DMT state, what's happening is that world model is changing. DMT is perturbing this complex world-building machinery of your brain and causing it to start constructing an entirely different model, which in itself is remarkable. Right. But this transition phase between the normal waking world and the DMT world is very chaotic. Like the brain takes time to kind of settle. It's like tuning the dial of a radio, or one of those old radio stations where it kind of, first of all, it's very noisy. And then then the new channel kind of crackles into through the speakers. And that kind of similar thing happens. You get this initial very chaotic roller coaster phase, followed by confusion and like, where the fuck am I? What's going on? But my predicted is if you kept someone in the space long enough, that would eventually start to stabilize. So the chaotic, wild tumult would give way and start to settle down, and you could actually start to navigate and explore the space in a much more systematic or semi-systematic way, and actually establish communication with the beings within the space. You know, that was the original idea. We should be going in there and establishing two-way communication.
Love you, Lumi Labs. Thank you for supporting this podcast. Just yesterday, I went into the medicine cabinet and I found some microdose gummies from Lumi Labs. Oh, what a joy to realize that I had not run out of my sweet, perfect, delicious, excellent microdose gummies. I'm telling you, friends, it's the perfect dose. No more edible terror. No more wondering if the edible that you ate is going to be the thing that pushes you one edible over the line and create the possibility that you might wake up in Bangladesh wearing a wizard's outfit, standing in front of an altar to a god you've never heard of before. No, no, no. This is the perfect dose. It's relaxing. It's great if you've got a long flight, if you are wanting a little extra help falling asleep. Thank God for Lumi Labs microdose gummies. Even better, it's available nationwide. To learn more about microdosing THC, go to microdose.com, use code Duncan to get free shipping and 30% off your first order. Links can be found at duncantrussell.com, but again, it's microdose.com, code Duncan. Thank you, Microdose. Can you send me more gummies, please?
That was the original idea. We should be going in there and establishing two-way communication, seeing what we can learn. And that seems to be the case. It seems to be that you can enter that space. You can be held there. Your brain DMT levels seem to remain fairly constant as long as the infusion is switched on. So, it's kind of set the stage, if you like, for much more detailed and comprehensive studies where subjects can be sent into the DMT space and given experiments to do, looking at the structure and the geometry and the topology and the patterns in the space, the entities, mapping the entities, communicating with the entities, the language. You can imagine like Arrival, have you seen the movie, right? Arrival.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, right. So you would have the linguist, the cunning linguist, old joke.
I mean, that is a question. I mean, you gotta wonder. I love talking to him, but how far can our relationship go?
Right. So that the linguist would be on the outside waiting, and then they would say, you know, can you transmit information somehow,
right,
from within the DMT space? So you would have some tools. I mean, this is a whole technology that can be built up around this. How do you transmit information in real time from the DMT space into the normal waking space, so to speak? And you'd have the team on the outside, the mathematicians, the linguists, the anthropologists, the theologians, maybe, when things get hairy. It's you can imagine this whole team, including the explorer, him or herself, and maybe there might be more than one. You might have a team that go in together into the DMT space. And
now that's
corroborating. Yes.
That's where it gets real. That's where it gets real. Because if, you know, with this technology, you have people maybe separated so that they're not next to each other. There's no way to communicate with each other and have them report what's happening. And you do find they're both having coherent view of the same terrain, the same entities. Holy shit. Now we've really stumbled upon something. Now we have the proof, you know, the real proof that, we're linked in ways that we don't that up to now have not been proven. And I that is incredibly exciting. And I'm sure that there's a lot of people with a lot of money who would be interested in discovering if this is really the case, because sadly, you know where a lot of the money comes from.
Yeah.
Starbucks. They're gonna want to put a logo in there. Can we get a Starbucks in the DMT realm?
But that's really. I mean, that would be earth shattering. That kind of discovery where you can actually put people in. And I know from people have told me, people who I think are perfectly reliable, but purely anecdotally, they've said, particularly people who are very close to each other, like, you know, husband and wife, they would say, I went into the DMT space and saw this entity. My wife was doing it at the same time. And then when we both came back, we were both describing to each other seeing the same entity.
Why were you staring at that entity's tits?
Yeah, that kind of thing. So that, you know, it shows you perhaps it's tantalizing, right? You could never publish that, of course. You could in some the 14 times or something, but you couldn't publish that in a scientific journal. But it kind of gives you a taste of what could be possible with a well-designed study. I mean, the parapsychologists have been doing these kind of studies on telepathy and clairvoyance for decades now. So they know how to do it. They know how to set up the experiment. To kind of definitively confirm that two individuals that were separated, that have no means of communication, nor normal means of communication, are actually entering the same space at the same time, that could be corroborated independently. That would be, you know, how would they explain that?
Right.
I don't know. Yeah.
quantum entanglement, maybe. I know. I saw a paper that came out about speculating that the human brain is a quantum computer, that there's some kind of entanglement happening. When I was high, I wasn't like, I got to figure out what's going on in my brain. I was like, I got to get more acid. We need more of this. I wasn't on the internet. So this is where I smashed into the wall of science. But I want to talk to you about what you think the implications are of this other neurological radio channel, so to speak, that somehow with the, whatever, the, I don't know if you'd call it a symbiosis, but somehow with the help of this molecule, your brain tunes in to a reality that is completely different from ours, obviously, but seems just as real. And the implication there, what is this? What does that mean? Is it, are we maybe tuning into some aspect of what we used to be? Was that just reality for the, the evolving human? Or is it as though our brains are just, oh, right, okay, we're doing that thing again that we evolved out of because of, it didn't help us with predators. You can't see the lions when you're in the DMT state. Or do you have theories on what that place is, or as many of us hope, it's not some, you know, biological explanation, but rather where it's actually just a window into a parallel reality that is simultaneously existing with ours, not some archetypical encoded, you know, Jungian bio reality, but you know, a swap.
Yeah, I get you.
Okay.
I think so. First of all, I think it's important to explain why it's so difficult to explain the DMT state, because it's easy. It's so easy to say, oh, it's just hallucination. That's all it is. Your brain is making it up. Your brain is a very creative machine, and it's creating these realities because you are on drugs, right? And that's the kind of hand-waving non-explanation that you will get, often from scientists, actually. But actually, it's, you know, you spoke about evolution there and escaping from the lion or hunting the lion, whichever way it is. But, the world that you experience, your own personal subjective reality, is a model of the environment that your brain has evolved to construct. Your brain has spent, or the human brain, or brains generally, have spent millions of years learning how to construct functional models of the environment. Building a world isn't an easy task.
Right.
If you look around, just look around you and look at the detail and the information and the complexity just of your visual world.
Right.
You know, I often say to people, you know, imagine how many words would it take for you to describe the scene in front of you now such that a skilled artist could reproduce it with photographic precision. How much information is there in your world? It's extremely difficult, and it's all got to be unified, and it's all constantly changing, and your brain has to keep up with it. This is an incredibly difficult task. So the reason I'm saying that is because it's so difficult to build a world. Your brain really should know how to build only one world,
right,
which is the normal waking world. That's the world your brain has spent millions of years. And throughout your life, your brain has been fine-tuning and honing the structure and dynamics of this world. Like learning a very, very difficult language. But then something strange happens. You inject this drug into your body, or you smoke this drug. This drug enters your brain, this very simple plant alkaloid that's ubiquitous throughout the natural world. It enters your brain, and your brain suddenly starts constructing this completely different world that has no relationship whatsoever to the normal waking world. It does it effortlessly. This crystalline, clear, inordinately complex world, hyperdimensional reality filled with these incredibly detailed and intelligent beings that are like nothing you could have imagined, nothing that you will ever find in the flora and fauna of the plains of Africa, right? Yeah. These are beings that you could not have imagined. They're unimaginable in their complexity and their form. Spaces that are unimaginable in their geometry and their topology and their color and their structure, their complexity, everything. It's like, where did the brain, how does the brain know how to do this?
Right.
When did the brain evolve to be constructing these realities? Because that's what it has to do. Let's make that clear. Even if the DMT reality is a real place, and I don't discount that, if it is some other place, for you to see it, your brain has to be able to build a model of it.
Right.
So the only way you can see the normal waking world now is because your brain is constructing a model of it. Whatever there is outside in the environment, you can never kind of directly access it. Right. All you have access to is this model that your brain is constructing and then testing against sensory information. So for you to see, the same applies in the DMT space. For you to see the DMT world, your brain has to be constructing a model of that reality. So that's right. Where it becomes really interesting, because then yeah. you have to say, you know, the brain is like switching to a completely new language that it never learned. It never went to school to start constructing DMT realities and machine elves. And yet suddenly, when you just perturb it with this very simple molecule, it starts building these worlds. And you go like, how the it's to me, you know, when I first started looking at this, like 15 years ago, you know, as a scientist started looking at it, I thought, this is confounding. I have to write a paper about this because this is really not easy to explain. People say it's just hallucination, or it's just a kind of dream. But most dreams are like the normal waking world, or they're variations on it. They're less stable, they're more fluid, but still, your brain is using the same information. It's using the same models that it's learned about the normal waking world to build your dream world. It doesn't take anything, in most cases, from the normal waking world and use it. It's using a completely different material. Right. It's entirely novel patterns of activity. It's like, what's going on here? To me, that doesn't make any sense. Unless there is some alternate space there, if the brain is receiving, if somehow DMT is gating the flow of information, this alternate source of sensory information from this other place, wherever it is, then your brain has the information to start constructing this new reality.
Right. Yeah. That's so wild. Like, you know, and I love, you know, just in general, like neurobiology and the way that it, you know, I just love, it used to scare the shit out of me when you hear it for the first time, when someone points out, you know, everything you're experiencing is your mind. It's your brain translating phenomena into the human experience, but it's happening inside of you. Everything you see is your mind. This is a Buddhist idea, you know, it's like, but when you hear it at first, it's terrifying to think that, because you're like, my God, well, what the fuck is out there if all I can see is this? I mean, the implication, we know we can't see ultraviolet light, blah, 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 all that stuff. But theoretically, maybe at some point as the human eye is developing, we couldn't see predators. We couldn't see the tiger or the bear or the snake. It just looked like part of the landscape. And suddenly one of us would die and nobody would know why. They'd be like, oh, that thing happened again. What is it? You know? And then somehow eventually you started distinguishing, oh, fuck, it's a snake. There's snakes there. So this, whatever this is, it's like, oh my God, is that what's happening? It's not a reversion to some primordial dream reality, but rather it's a natural part of human evolution. It's just now we're really sticking our head up above water, so to speak, and seeing something out there that is more real than this potentially, and something that that could be just as useful in terms of survival or expression as the first people who were able to distinguish snakes from grass or tigers from, you know, I don't know, foliage or whatever they're in, you know? So this is, to me, this is why what your research and what you're doing is really intensely exciting. And the fact that it's happening now, I mean, do you ever think about that? That this technology is being tested while what appears to be a strong AI comes online, when nuclear fusion has happened. Do you ever like look at the other things that are emerging right now alongside suddenly having a telescope into the DMT realm and think, holy shit, it's the singularity. It's really happening. McKenna wasn't bullshitting.
No, exactly. I was just going to say, you know, when Terence McKenna spoke about concrescence, the idea everything's kind of this tightening spiral and everything's being pushed together in really, really more and more tightly and faster as well. And you definitely get the sense that there's you feel the kind of the synchronicity there, and that you have this technology for what appears to be gating access to this incredibly technological realm. You know, the DMT right. space is typically described as being extremely advanced, you know, billions or trillions of years ahead of us, or yes. what we would imagine. That's also interesting, is because we imagine linearly. So we think this must be billions of years ahead of us, the DMT space. But actually, you know, when you're on the asymptote, you know, that exponential curve, you can actually be pretty close to where it shoots off to infinity and you're still quite kind of low down, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
Yeah. So it could be that actually we're communicating with beings that are maybe, you know, 31 years ahead of us.
Holy shit.
You know what I mean? And it's like, we've no idea what's coming.
Yeah, so we think it's some incredible alien thing. It's like, no, it's the PlayStation 8, actually.
Right.
It's ripples from the PlayStation 8 going backwards through time. And for whatever reason, when you smoke DMT, you just see this cool game.
Right.
Yeah, right. But truly, holy, that's so crazy, man, to think that. Yeah, you witness that and you're like, my God, whatever this is, it's been around for billions of years. It's older than us. It's from Sirius or some shit. But it's like, no, this might just be right around the corner.
Right
around the corner. This episode of the DTFH has been supported by my dear HTML wizards over at squarespace.com. I could go through all of the wonderful things about Squarespace, which actually I need to for the ad read. For example, it's easy to use. You want to create a website quickly, you can do that with Squarespace. They've got mix and match templates. It's easy to throw something together if you want to, but if you want to create a beautiful, complex thing of severe beauty, deep, hardcore website like the one you'll find at duncantrussell.com, you can do that too. Even better, if you're wanting to create a website for your podcast, they have got the ability to create a members-only area, a paywall, so you can give extra content to your fans. If you want to send out emails to your clients, you can use Squarespace's incredible technology to create beautiful emails. They also have excellent customer support. I couldn't recommend them more. I've been using them for years and have yet to experience a problem. Squarespace is the shit. And even better, you can try it out for free by going to squarespace.com/Duncan. When you're ready to launch, use offer code Duncan and you'll get 10% off your first order of a website or a domain. Again, it's squarespace.com/Duncan. Use offer code Duncan. You'll get 10% off your first order of a website or a domain. Thank you, Squarespace. it's older than us. It's from Sirius or some shit. But it's like, no, this might just be right around the corner.
Right
around the corner.
Right. So that's you have to think, and humans are not built for thinking. I forget who said it, but he said man's greatest failing is his inability to understand the exponential function. So we only think linearly. It's like that question of if you grow a bacteria and it fills up a jar, right? You know, it doubles.
Yeah.
And it's full at midnight. When is it half full? It doubles every minute. And it's full at midnight. When was it half full? It's half full at 11:59. Yes. People say, I don't know, like 2 years ago, but it's actually because it's the exponential function. So things are increasing faster and faster and faster and faster, and that causes them to increase faster. Yeah. So that's what Terence McKenna was speaking about here, in terms of this increasing novelty. And if you actually look back, of course, imagine yourself 100 years ago, and then imagine looking forward and seeing what we have now. I mean, we're talking to each other on a video, other side of the world. We have these visionary objects that we carry around in our hands where we can communicate. All of this would be completely insane. It would be magic. So we have to think, okay, what would that... Let's translocate all of that. We're 100 years behind whatever there is 100 years in the future. What's that going to look like? And we can't imagine. So we kind of think, oh, we're going to have hoverboards and we're all going to be wearing...
Hoverboards.
Yeah, that's it, right? Yeah, that was what was going to happen, yeah?
Yeah, hoverboards.
Yeah,
that
hover
was
cars.
It, and like cool vests.
Yeah, cool vests. Kind of metallic. Everyone with metallic vests. They'd all be very sexy. And that was the future. In 1983, Tomorrow's World. Did you have that in America, Tomorrow's World?
We had Back to the Future. You know, same idea. Like you saw the Spielberg. Yeah, like, yeah, I know what you mean. Yes. Yeah, Disney, it had a thing like that, which showed, like, you know, people were still eating TV dinners. They just looked cooler. It was
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Cornflakes were blue. I remember that. Like, what's life going to be like in 2000? She had a bowl of blue cornflakes in the morning. It was like a day in the life of somebody in the year 2000.
Blue cornflakes. One day they'll figure out how to turn cornflakes blue.
Yeah, no imagination, these people. But anyway, that was it. So I think you have that. So first of all, that's the first point, right? We don't know where things are going to be in 10 years' time. But then you start to see the signs, the gathering. It's like the birds, right? Where they're gathering on the climbing frame, that scene.
Right.
Like, oh, fuck. Something's going to happen here. And then all hell breaks loose and all the children get attacked, right? So this is like that stage that the ravens, the crows are gathering on the climbing frame. AI is there.
You just gave me goosebumps.
DMG.
You just gave me serious fucking goosebumps, man. Oh, God damn it. Holy shit. That's so incredible and terrifying and beautiful. Do you feel frustrated a little bit? I feel frustrated by what seems to be a lack of excitement for these gathering ravens. A lack of, have you played around with the new GPT bot? Have you had any conversations with this thing at all?
I haven't. I've read a lot of them and people have sent me them, often about me. People have been asking the chatbot about me. What would Andrew Gallimore say here? And it's like, I don't know.
What are its opinions of, how's it feel about you?
I think one of my friends said, I asked this chat, whatever it's called, chatbot thing. I said, I don't even know what it's called, ChatGPT. I don't know.
But anyway, GPT something.
Yeah, something like that. About what would Andrew Gallimore say about, you know, something about DMT? And it's fairly accurate, but it's fairly kind of obvious stuff. I mean, if it's able to trawl, if it gets access to my website, which it probably did, which is public, right?
Yeah.
I'm sure construct something that sounds like what I'd say.
It seems like it did some kind of web crawl prior to. I mean, on the website it says like after 2022, it's you can't say it. So whatever the data sets it fed it or there, it's not. At least it claims to not have access to the internet anymore. But to me, I agree. The language functioning of the thing, you can. It's not as though it's perfectly going to replicate what you're going to say. But again, like if you 5 years ago, holy shit, that would be the most incredible thing. And also its ability to create code. That's where it gets incredible. Like, can you write JavaScript for this program I want to make? And it'll just spit it out. Now, this is to me where we approach McKenna's singularity in the way he described it as the amount of time between what you can think and that thing existing in the world exponentially shrinks down. So, you know, to tell the thing, hey, can you blah, 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 and then it makes it. I mean, oh, what's next? Can you 3D print I don't know, whatever it is you want, and then woof, 3D prints this thing out. Now we're extruding into the material universe, you know, human consciousness, human innovation, much faster than we used to be able to. Add that to your technology. Add that to that. So it's like, can, you know, have the AI as the intermediary, the combination of the theologian, the combination of the psychologist, the combination of whatever, just there to sort of do the translation into not just language, but a visual, instantaneous visual form, even potentially taking those geometric objects and translating them through 3D printers so that now that realm is actually leaking into ours. That's, you know, that's where shit gets really weird. I mean, whether this is a existing realm or just some aspect of the human psyche, who gives a fuck when technology allows it to begin to grow into our realm in ways that we haven't been able to do yet, because how the fuck do you replicate some of those things? We don't have a language for that. How do you replicate it with, you know, Alex Gray? Some artists are pretty good at doing it, but that's where it gets weird. Right?
That's that. Yeah. I've never quite put it together like that. It's a beautiful idea, but yeah, I think, and the technology seems to be kind of close. I mean, if you can write code, if you can tell a chatbot to write code, then it can, as you say, it can 3D print something. So you can imagine having someone within the DMT space, and they could write the program for the communication device, right? Yeah. So you would have some kind of communication device that would be, you know, on your hand, like a keyboard, like Timothy Leary's experiential typewriter. He back in the 1960s, but much more advanced. It would design that. This artificial intelligence would design it. It would tell you exactly the kind of information you needed to bring back, and it would translate it in real time. And it could be constructing objects with the same geometry as these hyperdimensional Fabergé eggs. You have to think about. Or it might construct the equations, the hyperbolic algebraic equations that would allow you to reproduce them in a computer. So you can look at what is the actual structure of these spaces. Are they possible? Is there some new mathematics that's coming out of the DMT space? That kind of, right? It could go so much further. You could have it translating the languages. So that's people often describe, and Alison Gray, Alex Gray's wife, has these alien language paintings, right?
Yeah.
But these are just kind of approximate representations of the kind of things that she's seen. What if we could have somebody actually reproduce in real time these symbols, these alien languages, and feed them directly into an artificial intelligence, which would then
decode
the language, basically, and learn the rules of the language. I mean that is mind-blowing, but it feels like we're not so far from that now. So certainly I think that the intersection, I hate that word, but I'm going to use it this time, the intersection between AI and DMT and virtual reality and all of these technologies, they feel like they're all coming together, and all it needs is the imagination of someone who's willing to to think deeply about the application of these together, and you're going to, we're going to be in some wild, unimaginably strange spaces in the next few years.
So this is, and I know that you're familiar with this. I think McKenna talked about like the, our idea of what a UFO looks like, and you know, how a UFO lands is very much the way in the 80s we described what the future would be, metallic craft, beings come down the ramp that they walk up and down or whatever. And but when we start looking into the, and I'll say it, intersection between technology and psychedelics, specifically DMT, and that technology creating a sort of solid connection instead of the warbly connection based on maintaining a certain level of DMT in the bloodstream. But now we've opened the gate to whatever that is, and we are recording it in technological ways, as you mentioned earlier, translating the language, coming up with the maps. But this is where it gets really, really interesting, because these beings that you encounter, it's not just that they all want to show you Fabergé eggs and make you laugh. Some of them seem like they really like have something important to tell us. They want to communicate to us ideas, share their technology with us. I mean, that might be what the display of these, whatever these things are, is like, no, it's not just like a cool thing to paint on a water bong. Like, this is, we're trying to show you like ways to do things in your world that you haven't figured out yet. Like, these are bits of technology where it might not be that we're even seeing a language. We could be seeing circuitry. We could be seeing who knows what. Like, they might be showing us maps that we need. And so, you know, this is where that intersection gets fascinating, because suddenly there's a strange potential that the DMT realm begins to is the thing that pushes us up the hockey stick, that is the thing that, you know, via technology currently, like that we're currently just now getting access to, pushes us into whatever that the next level of human evolution is. And I know that sounds so cheesy, but my God, it's truly, to me, it might be one of the components that produces the singularity that McKenna and Kurzweil and everyone talks about.
Yeah, so humans are, we're at this really interesting, I mean, obviously we're at an interesting stage of our development. But if you think about imagine the long-term trajectory of an intelligent species, it spends most of its time in a kind of pre-technological phase where it is. So you can imagine us basically anytime before 1900, really, we were kind of pre-technological, going all the way back to, you know, infinite time in the past or whenever. Then we hit this technological phase, and we're really in it now. We're really deep in this technological phase. This technological phase probably only lasts in total a few hundred years, being generous. And after that, we probably hit the post-biological phase. So this is when we learn to effectively dispense with the biological form, where we realize it is no longer necessary. We are able to instantiate ourselves in another form. I'm not just talking about uploading our brain waves onto the latest Pentium processor or something like that. That's how people imagine it, you know, uploading ourselves onto a computer. I don't think it's going to be like that, but I think there will be we already understand that the human brain is effectively this information generator that generates these patterns of information, and that our reality is in a sense perhaps at the ground level is instantiated in some kind of digital information. Doesn't mean it's a simulation, but it just the way that reality is constructed. But I think we will learn eventually to instantiate ourselves, our intelligence, our life, deep within the structure of reality. So we're going inwards, if you like. Rather than looking out and heading for Mars or whatever, actually, because slight tangent, but there's, have you heard of the Kardashev scale?
Yes, but will you remind me? I've heard of it, but yes, I know the Kardashev scale. Yeah, it's like, hold on, let me try to remember the Kardashev scale. Come on, dummy. You can remember the Kardashev scale. It's for cooking, right? It's like a scale.
That's it, yeah.
I know. Please tell me what it is. I'm sorry for the dumb joke. You're a scientist. Forgive me. Please tell me.
So the Kardashev scale, it kind of goes back to a guy called Kardashev, funnily enough. And basically he said, you know, that intelligent civilizations, they will progress through various levels of technological. I forget the exact levels, but it's not too important. But basically we're kind of a level zero civilization, and then you get to a level one civilization, which might learn to control the energy of its star. Then a level two, where they might learn to control the energy of the whole solar system. And you can imagine it's going outwards. So we're starting to control more and more of the cosmos around us, ultimately, until we become galactic. You know, we have like a Death Star, and
finally,
you know, the whole, finally, right? We have control over the whole galaxy,
yes.
Right? Fighting the Rebel Alliance. Anyway,
yes.
But actually, now that's a beautiful idea and it makes great movies. But actually, if you think about the way that we are actually, I said actually three times that, I
love
do apologize.
It's fine.
That's appalling, isn't it? Appalling. Can we cut one of the angels out in post?
Like, it took all the ums and likes in my language out. There'd be like 3 minutes of me talking during each hour.
So, okay, let me say that. Let me reiterate that. So, in fact, actually, if you actually look, oh my God, give up. We don't look outwards. We don't, if you think about human development, my God.
You can say actually as many times as you want. I give you permission. Say actually what? Suddenly
it's something in my head now. It's like,
also,
what the fuck
I'm
are you
trying
doing
to think
there,
of other
dude?
Words for actually. We can pull up the chorus if you want.
We tend not to look at the cosmos. We're playing around on the moon a little bit and we're sending things to Mars. But in fact, we're looking inwards with things getting smaller. It's all about nanotechnologies.
Right.
We're not trying to control the cosmos, control the galaxy. We're actually trying to control atoms and subatomic particles. We're going inwards. So John Wheeler, I think, very famous physicist, said there should be another scale, not one that's pointing outwards, but a scale that's pointing inwards, because that is actually what humans seem to be doing.
Yeah,
they're progressing inwards. They're getting closer and closer to the ground of reality. And to me, that's the secret. We have to flip our thinking. We're too wedded to starships and galactic citizenship and the Rebel Alliance and all that fun stuff. Whereas in reality, we're actually looking inwards.
Inward.
And so we start to control. We're already at the stage. I forget what type or what level we are. But we're already at the stage. We're like type minus three or something. Where we're able to control individual atoms and construct things. We already understand the subatomic, the structure of the atom. We start to control that. As we go deeper and deeper, we get to a point where we're able to manipulate the structure and dynamics of the ground of reality, of space-time, and perhaps even below that, the absolute fundamental ground of reality. Then it all opens up. Can we then manipulate this? Can we embed ourselves in some way, in a more fundamental way? Can we embed ourselves and instantiate our intelligence in the ground of reality? That's, to me, sounds like a more likely progression than taking over star systems.
Right.
But then that leads to an interesting, it leads you onto a kind of an interesting trajectory, because then you think, well, what would that look like? What would it look like if you understood and were able to embed yourselves deep within the structure of reality, which might be nine dimensional? You know, the string theorists love to tell us there's actually nine dimensions, right? If we were actually able to embed ourselves we would become this post-biological intelligence that was extremely advanced, that could manipulate the structure of the reality around it. And we'd be ahead. There'd be other beings that would be left behind in our three-dimensional world, kind of doing it on meat, so to speak, like we are now. So then you think, well, wait a minute. What happens when I smoke DMT? I seem to be accessing this domain that's populated by these incredibly intelligent beings that seem to exist in this high-dimensional space. They're able to manipulate the structure of their reality around them. They form themselves out of their own material. And it's like, are we actually communicating with, are we actually interfacing with that post-biological space? Right. Is the machine, the world of the machine elves and these hyper-dimensional beings, these hyper-intelligent, hyper-technological beings, is that in fact just the world that we are heading towards? Perhaps in the next 31 years, as I said.
So this answers the Fermi. This is like a great answer to the Fermi paradox, which is no technological, no advanced. At some point, the beings that are becoming technological realize, whatever that shit is, it's way more inaccessible than going inward. It's way more difficult to populate. It's mostly just space out there anyway. Yeah. And that's where they stumble upon what you're talking about, which is the action is within, not outside. And then this is why we would understand why there's nothing out there, because what's the point? But here's where this is why I would like your thoughts on this. Many people, I'm one of them who have smoked.
Many people, did you say?
Many, no, not many people. You know, not many people. I'm very small. I have a filter on that makes me look like I'm full size. I'm actually 2 feet tall. Many people. when people smoke DMT, there's a familiarity. There's a sense of, I kind of know this place. Mixed in with the wildness, there's a feeling of, oh yeah, this place, I know what this is. Coming home feeling. Oh yeah, I do this sometimes. Have you heard of that before? The familiar sense within that alien landscape, a feeling of familiarity with the place itself.
Oh yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's one of its defining characteristics. There are a number of things that people describe about DMT space. One is that it's the most bizarre and wild and unimaginable place that they could never have possibly comprehended or imagined. And at the same time, it's weirdly familiar. And this profound sense of deja vu. And it's like you're being like, and they're kind of teasing you. The entities, they will say, do you remember? Do you get it yet? Do you remember? Yeah. And you're like, no, this is fucking wild. And you're like, yeah.
Come on.
You know, they love kind of, I think they enjoy that, this kind of pranksterish, mischievous. Like they can see that we haven't got a fucking clue. And yet they know deep down that we're kind of perhaps part of their realm, that we're kind of, we're like the prodigal son who's disappeared out of their realm temporarily. And we kind of occasionally check back in, but we don't remember ever being there. So I get that sense as well. And also the quite explicit celebrations when people burst into the space and it's like, woo, the bells will start ringing, the lights are flashing, it's like a big show, and it's like your name will be up there in lights, literally. And the elves will be singing a song for you and say, he's returned, you know. That is really, really fucking wild and astonishing. And it makes you think. It makes you think, like, there must be, there's something going on here. That's the thing about DMT, I think. When you put it all together, everything, all, yes, each aspect of DMT is on its own amazing. The complexity of the worlds, the strangeness of the beings, the fact that it's everywhere in nature, everywhere you look, you know, countless plants contain DMT. It's ubiquitous. It's in the human body. It's metabolized very quickly by the brain. The brain is very at home with DMT. This sense of deja vu, it all comes together and you can't help. And you also can't communicate to other people who've never taken it, but you can't help feel this profound sense that this is, there's something really, really important. There's this deep connection. It's not so much, I wrote in one of my papers a few years ago, it's not so much an alien world, but a world from which we have become alienated.
Whoa,
that's... Write it down. That's my quote. Yeah.
I read that Rick Strassman said that. I remember when I heard him say that at a convention. So to get back to this idea of going inside, going deeper, at some point, is it that it's not so much we discover this ability to encode ourselves into the deepest data set of reality, but more that we remember we've already done that.
Yeah.
In fact, yes, we are like flowering out into this particular aspect of time space, and death is just when the flower petals drop, and then you just go back to the light show, to wherever that is, and everyone's so happy to see you, and then, you know, you do it again. Or is it like McKenna would talk about, the Eleusinian mystery schools? Is this an initiation? Are we doing the futuristic equivalent of when you see people who stick their hands in the gloves filled with ants? Only in this case, it's not a glove filled with ants. It's a planet filled with other people who have forgotten that there's more to them than this. And thus the celebration would be one you might expect at some kind of initiation, at some kind of like, you did it. You're one of us.
Yeah.
Now. Welcome. Right. Welcome. You did it. What we could think of as the apocalypse, the singularity, is it just like all of us are simultaneously, whatever batch of initiates we happen to be, are simultaneously coming down, waking up, returning together to whatever this place was?
Yeah, I think so. And if you think about DMT, I mean, using DMT, discovering DMT, it requires quite a lot of intelligence. It takes a long time for a human being to reach the stage where they can identify this molecule, isolate it. That requires chemistry. I mean, this is something right. that a chimp couldn't achieve. You can't just munch on DMT complaining plants. You have to isolate it, purify it. Then, and that only happened in 1956, of course, after hundreds of thousands of years of human evolution. So it's a long story. Long story of evolution and development, and now we're kind of starting to understand. I hope I'm telling people they should start to see DMT as, take seriously the idea that DMT is a technology, and we're learning to develop it as such. So we're learning to go beyond the kind of the glass pipe and popping our head into this domain, and learning to actually maintain ourselves in there, to spend more and more time in there. So there's a huge journey that goes from the beginning of human evolution, or the beginning of, you know, the development of the emergence of life on Earth, all the way up to this point. So of course there's going to be a fucking celebration. It's like, wow, we're kind of popping our heads above the clouds, and seeing what's beyond. It's like, oh my God, how long did it take for us to achieve this? So yeah, when you burst into this realm, even though it is at this point a few minutes, right? 3 or 4 minutes, it's like, yay, finally he made it. We'll see you again soon. And they say goodbye and they wave and say, we'll see you soon. They know that we finally found we finally found our way home, but we can only kind of pop our head in, you know, around the door briefly, and then we have to go again. But soon, perhaps, I'm not saying this is true, but yeah, it feels like we're reaching the stage now where we have reached the stage now where we can spend 30 minutes, an hour, 2 hours, days. There's no limit here. What happens then? Do we find a way to permanently instantiate ourselves into the, is that going to be part of what post-human life looks like, is where we learn to instantiate ourselves into this bizarre domain? I don't know. I don't know if I'd want to be there permanently, but it feels like, you know, and of course it's always going to be shocking and disorienting. People go, oh my God, you know, just like when you burst from the womb, I guess. I imagine, yes, it's like, put me back.
Right.
But you don't really want to go back now, do you? I mean, I'm kind of over it, if I'm honest.
Definitely. That is not where I want to go back for. But yeah, I get the analogy. And yeah, I think that I've heard, you know, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, all the Buddhists, when they talk about enlightenment, you know, anyone who gets into meditation, the first thing, like, God, I want to get enlightened. You don't even know what that means. We're like, it'd be fucking cool to be enlightened. But all of the Rinpoches, the lamas, they all say, it's really not a big deal. Like, in fact, it only seems like a big deal in the same way if you've been standing on your head your entire life and somebody got you back on your feet. For a second, you'd be like, what the fuck? This is crazy. And then it would just be normal reality for you. So yeah, the comparison, I totally understand. It could just be that that wildness or whatever it may be. It also may be, as you were talking about earlier, that our brains haven't fully learned how to decode that reality, that our brains are just doing their best to decode the reality. But the longer you're in there, the more refined that ability becomes, and maybe the less bizarre things seem. I don't know, but I got to tell you, man, your research is mind blowing. And can you talk about your new book? You have a little bit more time to talk about your new book.
Always.
It looks so cool. I can't wait to get a copy, man. It is badass.
Well, I'll send you a copy. Reality Switch Technologies, Psychedelics as Tools for the Discovery and Exploration of New Worlds. So, yeah, it's a book. Basically, it's what I consider to be, and Hamilton Morris agrees with me, so there, is that it's the is that it is by far the most kind of the deepest and most detailed account of how psychedelic drugs work in the brain available. It occurred to me 3 or 4 years ago that there isn't a really good book that really explains to a non-specialist, so not a scientist, somebody who's just a curious amateur, I would describe the kind of the average reader of my books, someone who's really interested in understanding what's actually going on in the brain when a psychedelic molecule enters, when DMT enters the brain, or when LSD enters the brain, or psilocin, or ketamine even. I talk about ketamine as well, and the tropane alkaloid like scopolamine or salvinorin. Why, when these enter your brain, does the structure and dynamics of your experienced world change, either subtly as a low dose of mushrooms or astonishingly dramatically with a high dose, a breakthrough dose of DMT. So the book is basically about a deep dive into the neuroscience, the neurochemistry, the pharmacology of psychedelic drugs, explaining in detail from the, you know, how do they interact with receptors? How do they change the way that neurons function? How do they, that change the way that neurons communicate with each other? And why does this cause your structure dynamics of your world to change? So yeah, that's the book. So if you're really interested in developing a really deep and satisfying understanding of what psychedelics are actually doing, then Reality Switch Technologies is the book, fully all written and designed by me. Very beautiful book. Yeah,
it is beautiful. Yeah, this isn't just the illustrations that I've seen online and just through that flip through. It's clearly you spent a long time on that book. It's beautiful.
Yes. Thank you. Yeah.
Andrew, thank you. Thank you for coming on the show. I hope you'll come back. This is, I think this might be one of my favorite episodes of the DTFH.
Wow.
Yay. Thank you so much. It's really nice connecting with you. You going to come to the United States anytime soon? Do you have any lectures coming up or any way we can see you live out here?
I've been a few times. I haven't been since that thing that happened over the last few years. It's quite difficult. It's easy to leave Japan. It's not that easy to get back in. You know what I mean? It's better now. But so yeah, things have opened up. So hopefully I will make it. Where was I last time? Oh, I was in Boulder, a few years ago. I gave a lecture there. San Diego, New York. But yeah, where are you?
I'm in Austin, and the pandemic didn't happen in Texas.
You're in Austin. Invite me to Austin. I'll come to Austin.
Come. Yeah. We've got a guest room. I would love for you to come. It's a beautiful place. It really is. It's wonderful. One of my neighbors has a cannon. he has an actual cannon. Like, I said to him, he was like, yeah, we fire it on the 4th of July. I'm like, can you tell me when you're going to fire it? I've never seen a cannon, like, actually fire a cannonball. And he's like, oh, to shoot the cannonballs, we have to go deep in the country. We can't shoot the cannonballs in the neighborhood.
No shit. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. You Americans are wild. You really are. Yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah. It's you and it's somehow in the midst of it, the sweetest, truly, like, you realize, there's nothing to worry about with that cannon necessarily. But anyway, look, why am I talking about cannons after our incredible podcast? Come, I mean it. That's not just podcast yap. If you want to come out to Austin, you can stay at our home, and bless you for all the work that you're doing in this department. And thank you so much for your incredible Twitter, your amazing Substack. Everybody, all the links you need to find Andrew will be at DuncanTrussell.com. But can you tell folks where they can find you?
Yes. So my website is alieninsect.net. There you've got links to many of my talks and interviews and papers that I've written, books you can buy, and that kind of stuff. I post, as Duncan says, quite regularly on Twitter. My Twitter handle is alieninsect. So I put lots of threads about psychedelic neuroscience and other ideas about psychedelics and other drugs. And my Substack as well. I publish weekly. Alien Insect on Drugs is my Substack. And again, you can link to all of this from my website, alieninsect.net. That's it.
It's been great chatting with you, Andrew. Thank you so much.
You too. Thank you very much.
Hare Krishna. That was Andrew Gallimore, everybody. Subscribe to his Twitter, his Substack, his Instagram. All the links are going to be at DuncanTrussell.com. And buy his brand new book, Reality Switch Technologies. A tremendous thank you to our sponsors. And a merry, merry Christmas, or whatever you may be celebrating, to thee. I love you, and I'll see you next week. Holy shit, we have a blazing podcast coming up with the renowned Brother Ali. I'll see you then. Till then, Hare Krishna.